Good evening and welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I'm Douglas Simpoga, and this evening we'll talk about the ongoing conflict in South Sudan. And with us tonight is Dr. Maji El Gizuli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute. The Rift Valley Institute is a non-profit research and training organization working with communities and institutions in Eastern Africa, including Sudan and the Horn of Africa. Maji joins us from Germany. Good day, good afternoon, Dr. Gizuli.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing good, thank you. How is Germany?
Oh, quite fine. Lovely weather these days.
Thank you very much. And Suleiman Mugula is a regular panelist and is joining us from Durban, South Africa. He's an independent political analyst. Good evening, Suleiman.
Good evening, Douglas.
I hope Durban is fine too.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, welcome once again to Reporters Roundtable. As I said, we are going to talk about the ongoing conflict in South Sudan. It's up now almost 6 months since the conflict erupted in December. Let me begin with Dr. Gizuli. 6 months down the road, it doesn't seem to be changing at all. No change is happening at all.
Well, how would you describe change? I don't think that things are changing. It's just a stalemate. Mm-hmm. But this situation was expected from the very beginning, that none of the two sides would have the upper military hand. Mm-hmm. Technically, the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, the army in South Sudan, has split into two, and these two sides are fighting each other. So there is no reason to believe that one or the other side would have sufficient military stealth to end this conflict quickly. And then, judging by the history of war in South Sudan, it was never resolved through the gun. Effectively, and for all practical purposes, there is no other solution to this issue than a political solution.
I see.
None of the two sides have displayed the sort of political acumen and readiness to resolve this crisis on the assumption that they could push on for a military win.
Talking of a political solution, still with you, as you know, yesterday the warring parties there agreed to form a provisional government of national unity by August. That's according to the mediators. Do you have a lot of hope in this forced provisional government arrangement?
Well, this seems to be an attempt to return to the status quo ante, that is, the situation in South Sudan before the eruption of the war, but it doesn't really address why the war erupted in the first place. So it's an attempt by both sides to return to the zero situation where both of them were in government. I mean, effectively, we're talking about two men who were sharing the presidency, one as president and the other as vice president. So for all practical purposes, all the people who are fighting now on Riek Machar's side 6 months ago were in government. Mm-hmm. So whatever provisional government might arise, if it is based on a division of spoils between the two warring parties, we would only be returning to the situation that resulted in the war in the first place.
I see. Suleiman, talking of this agreement to have a provisional government by August. This, as Maje rightly points out, this is the situation that attained not before the conflict broke out in December, but before that, when Salva Kiir dismissed Machar and other ministers. Some analysts have said it's like putting back the toothpaste back in the tube, and that maybe it may not hold. What do you think?
As my colleague has said, nothing much has changed. It seems the situation is still as it was. We have got hardened positions. What is appearing on surface is not what is the reality on the ground. It is very difficult to believe that a sensible compromise will be reached. As you recall, we are having three agreements already. We had the one 23rd January, we had the 6th May, we have the 9th May. Now this one of last Tuesday, this Tuesday, is the 4th. And none of those has been able to bring peace to Southern Sudan. Over and above, Douglas, we should not forget that this is a nation born out of very difficult circumstances. It was very clear from the beginning that the leadership was caught by surprise because towards the agreement during the presence of Garang, it was as if the nation was not ready to separate. Then all of a sudden, after the death of Garang, it turned into the secession. After the secession, I think we have failed to get leadership to be able to build a nation. And now, at the current state where we are, it seems we have got a total stalemate, and they are failing to bring a united Southern Sudan, and I doubt whether even within the 60 days they can be able to bring a united Southern Sudan, because the challenges, those which were there before the birth of the new nation, many of them are still existing.
Yeah, as Suleiman points out, even as they were agreeing to this provisional government issue, the UN sources reported yesterday that there was heavy gunfire and mortar shelling in Malakal, the capital of oil-producing Upper Nile State. Dr. Gizuli, Suleiman points there to the way the nature of how South Sudan was formed. Could this have any bearing on the current instability there?
Well, I mean, of course, obviously it does. I mean, this is a nation born out of war, but I wouldn't lay the blame on the solely on the history of conflict in South Sudan. I think rather than blaming the nation and how it came to be, the main issue here is the SPLM-SPLA. Now, you probably recall, Douglas, that the SPLM received almost carte blanche to rule South Sudan, unquestioned. It contested elections in 2010 before secession, where flagrant violations of electoral procedure were apparent for all to see, but nobody raised the question. There was no questions asked. It was given as if the SPLM had right of struggle to rule South Sudan. And this is the basis of its dominance today. Although at one point of time during the elections, it seemed as if there was a democratic challenge, or a challenge of any sort from other parties in South Sudan. Till today, the SPLM has ruled South Sudan unquestioned. So even the conflicts that might erupt within the country have to be resolved within the SPLM structure. So it's as if you're asking the disease to be the cure. In my eyes, as long as you're looking into the SPLM, sort of digging into the SPLM, seeking for a resolution to be born out of the political processes of the SPLM, you're looking in the wrong place. It is time to open these political processes to all stakeholders in South Sudan. You cannot collapse the nation with the SPLM. And this assumption of collapsing South Sudan with the ruling party is what has led us here, because obviously the SPLM was, I mean, effectively pampered through the transitional period and post-secession. Whatever violations it committed, whatever corruption charges were raised against officials, all this was excused in the name of liberation. And I think this blanket excuse that the SPLM had throughout its sort of evolution in government is one reason why we are where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Suleiman, further to that, there are people asking themselves, this provisional government of national interest, as proposed in this agreement they had yesterday, what would you expect from that? I mean, would these parties prepare the nation for, as Dr. Gizuli says, to open up and involve all the stakeholders and then allow for a free and fair election after that?
It's very difficult to tell, Douglas. Because from the body language of Riek Machar, he doesn't seem to recognize Salva Kiir. The fault lines have become wider between the two groups. A lot of blood has been shed. So the fault line, the size of the fault line seems not to allow a cooperation between the two. As I've said, when you look at Rich Mackell's body language, he doesn't seem to be willing to sit with Salva Kiir. Another biggest problem is the external interference. The presence of Uganda brings any cooperation so difficult, not only because Riek Machar is afraid of Uganda, but you have to know that Uganda has been involved in Sudan ever since. And number two, Riek Machar might have been forced to take the actions which he took, especially when he saw the bigger influence of Uganda, because Uganda is not a good example, is not a template to be used, because Uganda has been involved in Rwanda, Uganda has been involved in DRC. The nature of politics from Seven is not good for anybody to copy. The moment Salva Kiir was hand in gloves with Uganda, you could see that there is a problem as far as the peace and security of Southern Sudan is concerned. Remember, it was the same Uganda which was encouraging Salva Kiir to have a full-scale war with Sudan. So there is also a problem of the external interference, especially Uganda. They have refused to withdraw, and Riek Machar was not settled until when Uganda has withdrawn her soldiers from the Southern Sudan's fields.
Do you want to address briefly the involvement of neighbors, especially Uganda, who has forces in that country?
Well, of course, this is not really novel. I mean, the neighbors to South Sudan, be they what is now old Sudan, if you like, Uganda, Ethiopia, Eritrea, have all been intimately involved during the war and after the war. I mean, you might remember that in 1991, when the SPLA split in two between Machar and Garan, it was Ugandan involvement that really rescued the SPLA from the Sudanese onslaught, from the onslaught of the Sudanese army at the time. So Ugandan intervention has been sort of crucial for the success of the SPLA during the war and today, of course, for the maintenance of Salva Kiir's government. And as long as the South Sudanese can't get their situation in order, they will be exposed to these sort of, to use language from Sudan, to these sort of vicious interventions, be they from the Sudanese side or from the Ugandan side. As far as I can say, today Ethiopia is attempting to play a mediating role. But over time, this will become more and more difficult. I mean, as long, and you only had the DRC as an example, where at one point in time you had eight African armies fighting the territory of the DRC with external support from international actors. And my fear is that over time, as far as this conflict moves from an acute emergency to a chronic war over the period of the next months, we will see more of this sort of intervention. I mean, already you have the Ugandan army and you have major Sudanese rebel groups fighting on South Sudanese territory. And who knows who else will join.
Mm-hmm. All right, let us take a short break. We'll continue. We'll come back and continue a discussion of the situation in South Sudan after this very short break. Put your flags
up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC. and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC, every single day on The Voice of America.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you are listening to The Voice of America, and this is Reporters Roundtable. We're coming to you live from The Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the conflict in South Sudan. Our panelists are Maji El Gizuli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. And I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Washington Studio 9. Let me go to South Africa, to Suleiman now. And this arrangement, whatever it is, between Silva Kiir and Riek Machar, and agreeing to a provisional government of national unity, as Gizuli pointed out earlier on, doesn't include all the stakeholders. It seems to be a deal to appease the two principals. In that case, is it built on thin ground?
It is, because as we said, the challenges of the new nations had not yet been solved when this latest development happened. There were still questions of Abyei. There was still Yao Yao fighting. There were still other groups in the conflict. So the new nation was ambushed by so many problems. The Sudanese problem was still festering. So it had not yet settled. But even that were notwithstanding, we cannot fail to shift the blame on the leadership. Salva Kiir leadership, together with Riek Machar, has shown that the generation of leaders which we have on the continent has failed to provide good leadership. They have failed to look at the templates of other countries which are coming from conflict situations. We had the template of South Africa. Such countries like Southern Sudan, which are coming out of conflict, should have been able to copy on the humility of leadership within South Africa. What enabled South Africa to build a nation within a short time? The ability to rise above all the sectarian issues, the ability to rise above selfishness and then concentrate on building a nation. That was not done. In the wrong run, they were caught up. Now we are back to zero.
I see. Maji, there are issues. People are pointing out issues which are very urgent, issues of people who are displaced and have no shelter, issues of food shortages that are almost assured since people have not been able to plant their crops, and issues of security of person and property. All these issues are not being addressed now. What seems to be addressed or prioritized is the power-sharing deal.
Yeah, well, this tells you a lot about the deficit of this mediation model and the deficit of thought around South Sudan, as if this entire nation is restricted to these two men and the people behind them. And this is obviously an easy way out of the conflict in South Sudan, and it's very short-sighted, and it will cost South Sudan's partners much more than they think, because the only consequence out of that is to produce a longer war, because there is no clear incentive right now to end the war. Both principals assume that they can go on fighting in the hope of sealing a better power-sharing deal in the future. So as long as the model is simply power-sharing between the two sides, you will get this race for a better deal and procrastination and delay. And of course, we've seen that already in the Sudanese negotiation process which started with the IGAD intervention in the 1990s. Already in 1995, there was an IGAD declaration of principles. And you had one round after round of negotiations that got nowhere. And only in 2002 was it possible to sign the first serious agreement on the right of self-determination for South Sudan, and the CPA followed 3 years thereafter. So this type of time span will give you an impression of what we're looking at in the future. If we continue to think around South Sudan along the very simplistic model of power sharing between the principals, and one must repeat again and again that these two gentlemen have simply proved that they're grand failures. They have led a country that technically would be in a position to be a middle-income country, judging by the sort of oil revenue it is able to generate, into devastation. So the optimism that was around South Sudan was overwhelming, but it was an immense deficit of leadership, an immense deficit of political acumen at the level of the SPLM in general, I would say. Not only the two men, but the SPLM as a structure proved that it was not able to move from its guerrilla nature to a political party that could build a new country. And obviously, none of the international partners was ready to question this. Already in the 2000s, you had American military support for the SPLA. You had United Nations silence over all sorts of violations in South Sudan, be they during the disarmament campaigns in Jonglei or the disarmament campaigns in Upper Nile, all the sorts of rebellions that emerged already at the time of independence against the dominance of the SPLM leadership over the entire country, and the UN was silent in the hope that, well, these problems will sort themselves out. Well, obviously they didn't. And at one point in time, you had such a coalition like the one led by Riek Machar. I mean, Riek Machar is the principal, yes, of course, but he's not the head of a united front. He is the head of an alliance by convenience. I mean, convenience pushed a lot of people into the sort of alliance that Riek Machar wants to be heading. However, you might expect at the moment of signing a concrete deal that this very alliance that is now built around this singular figure will disintegrate into different factions that are looking for separate spoils. And all these factions are effectively born out of the SPLA. They are not born out of South Sudan. They're born out of this army come political movement.
Yeah, but then again, is it not true to suggest that maybe this current agreement seeks to preserve the SPLA?
Well, yes, effectively it does. I mean, it essentially says government in South Sudan will be the sole prerogative of the SPLM, SPLA. Nobody else is invited to the table, since you are going to divide government between the two factions of the SPLA that are fighting each other. But there is no readiness to look into the wider society of South Sudan. I mean, this is a country that has by force educated its citizens in diaspora, inside the country, outside. They are people who have accumulated some degree of political experience, who might be ready to produce another sort of leadership, but nobody is looking in that direction. They are invited only in the limited nature of church groups or anything against them, but church groups are not going to rule the country, nor are youth and women groups. I mean, this is not the sort of civil society that you want on the table. You want political actors on the table who can contribute to the type of political resolution that you have here. Of course, these wider groups are invited, but you're reducing the negotiation to, and like the IGAD process that is now ongoing, an intra-SPLA process is obviously very, very limiting.
I see.
Very limiting.
Yeah, and Suleiman, there are some analysts who have pointed out the nature of the tough neighborhood that South Sudan finds itself. And people have been praising IGAD for trying its best. But the players, you look at Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Uganda, some people have even argued that some of these neighbors don't want peace and stability in the new country.
Probably. Because, for example, a country like Uganda, what peace and security does it promise Southern Sudan? It has been a harbinger of war in Rwanda, in DRC, wherever it steps. So there isn't much, but even when you look at the way you have put it, when you look at the last conference which they had, there seemed to be no unity of purpose. In the last meeting, for example, Uhuru Kenyatta was not there. The representation was seen as if the IGAD itself is beginning to have cracks within. Mm-hmm. Number two, it's only not going to be a failure of IGAD. There is also silence from the AU, from the UN. There seems to be no outside help from this regional, continental, and international organization. Everybody has left this few countries, surrounding countries, to take charge without assistance, and yet they have got their baggage, which they are carrying, which may not be so so positive as far as the settling of the conflict is concerned.
I see. Maji, the IGAD member states have warned that they will take unspecified punitive action for further breaches by any of the warring parties. Do you believe IGAD, or if so, how so would that help?
I wonder what these punitive actions might be. I mean, IGAD is already undertaking some sort of punitive action in the sense that it has effectively condoned Ugandan intervention in South Sudan. So in a sense, it is the IGAD countries are already involved in the war. Simply naming whatever force exists already from outside, inside South Sudan, an IGAD force, does not change the nature of things. So I wonder what this action might mean. Let's wait and see what IGAD has to propose. I don't think punitive measures are helping anybody, really. What you need is to think of a negotiation model that will address this crisis more effectively than a division of spoils between two men who can't keep their guns shut.
And lastly, and briefly, because we're running out of time, do you believe that a third force maybe would help resolve this conflict? Because these two principles can't seem to move anywhere.
Well, I mean, South Sudan is not a small country. I mean, how large a force would you require to instill peace and security in South Sudan by the barrel of the gun? I mean, history is our record here. This is an almost impossible task. I don't think there is a military solution to this problem, neither from within South Sudan nor from without South Sudan. You can push in forces inside the country, but this would only exacerbate the war.
I see. So, Suleiman, in 10 seconds, what do you see? What's the way forward?
We need to widen the negotiating team, both in terms of the players. Within, as my colleague has said, we need to contact those people, the Southern Sudanese, not only the different factions within the nation, but also from the ASAPRA. We also need to bring in some other neutral negotiators. We need to widen the group. They need to widen the group that is discussing to make it more serious. And then also, the way my colleague has said, we need to widen the scope of leadership, not only to concentrate on the two factions, but to widen and look outside these two groups for possibly some solution of better leadership than the two, or only restricting ourselves to the two principles.
I see. Last 10 seconds, Dr. Jizuli, that's the way to go?
Well, I think the real pressure on South Sudan has to come from inside South Sudan. I can only support what my colleague in Durban has said, that this would come from the South Sudanese themselves. And this is the moment where regional players, international partners can come in to help empower South Sudanese who are now outside the political process to take things in their own hands against a failing leadership.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank Maji El-Ghazouli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute. Thanks a lot, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And thank you, Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. Thanks, Suleiman.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very
much. You're welcome. Our producer has been Jackson Mvunganyi. Our engineer tonight was Tole Palok. We'll be back again next week for another edition of Reporters Roundtable. In case you missed any part of this program, just go to our main website, click on programs, scroll down to Reporters Roundtable, and you can listen to the whole thing again. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you all the best.